Today, are we up the creek without a paddle? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news. Friday evening, Tarek's back. Tarek, hello. Nice to see you again. Boy, we are in interesting times.
We are indeed, Martin. You know, I find myself looking at my charts, which I started preparing yesterday, and just starting to feel like they were already getting a little bit out of date. So I had to, you know, go through and do a little bit more updates here and there, do a bit more changes, because there is just so much happening at the moment and so much to talk about. And it really is getting down to sort of like, you know, not quite life or death stuff, but it is the difference between, you know, the gap between everyday life and, hey, we're having a really major crisis.
Yeah, I've got this view that we're in a Schrodinger situation. You know, we're either dead or alive, depending on when you open the box and look what's happening, or depending on how this all turns out. Because on one side of the equation, you know, maybe things aren't too bad. But actually, if you take it the other way and think about how could this go and how could it go badly, well, it does become really quite existential. And then, of course, the question that immediately follows is, so do we have the political leadership to be able to actually lead us through? And will they end up, guess what, throwing more money at households to try and protect them? And I do make the observation that lifting interest rates by 0.25% really has made a huge difference to opening the Straits of Hormuz, hasn't it?
It has. And I think it is worth just taking a step back a moment and just reflecting on where we're at. You know, I mean, in the last 48 hours, you know, there was that Qatari LNG plant, which is responsible for basically 20% of the world's LNG exports, got taken out by the Iranians. Now, they say in terms of the lasting damage that basically 17% of Qatari LNG export capacity is now basically gone for the next 3 to 5 years, which is, you know, if we just do a bit of rough math, that's 3.5% of global LNG gone out of the market, you know, based not permanently, but for a very long time. And, you know, you look at what that powers, you know, that powers fertilizer production in China. It powers power production in Pakistan or in India. And you look at where we're at, and that's just one attack. You know, we are staring down the barrel of something here that, even if we just look at, say, for example, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, and we're sitting here in 6 months and that's still closed, the chances of a global recession are extremely high. If we look at a scenario where the Middle East oil infrastructure just gets fully, you know, scorched earth, just turned to ashes in a giant tit for tat between Iran and the various Gulf states and the US, that is more along the lines of global depression and one of the most serious famines in human history. And I just think that really needs to be emphasized, that is where we're at the moment. Those are the stakes if serious mistakes are made, or if, you know, someone makes a miscalculation. And that is a deeply, deeply concerning place to be.
Well, it is. And I think the attack on the oil and gas is really something which probably should have been seen as a potential consequences of doing what they did. You know, whether it was Israel who actually did it without consulting the US or not, I don't know. But it does suggest to me that there are some different agendas washing around the place that perhaps need to be a little more transparent. And the fallout, of course, is highly significant. And just to sort of give you a little bit of context on that, the latest on the this is the Brent futures sitting at around 106, which is, as you can see, quite extended compared with where it was. But it's the natural gas, of course, that is up at 61 now, compared with down at 28 to 30, which is where it was previously. Now, those are huge moves, the doubling of, you know, the gas price and those sorts of things. And when you think about it, the consequences are not equally spread across the globe, which is the other point that I think we need to think about. Now, Australia is quite significantly impacted because of the lack of onshore creation of energy, other than, of course, Australia is one of the biggest LNG producers, right? And so they're now talking about shipping more of the stuff overseas. And so that gives you then, well, can we tax the companies more to, you know, but that's not really going to help. Obviously, fuel is a big problem. But I do think the urea question and also the helium question is very, very significant. And the other point I wanted to make was, at the moment, of course, the big question in the Middle East itself is what happens if water assets start to get impacted too? Because, of course, most of the states in the Middle East are reliant on desal plants. And if that is where this goes, well, then that's hugely concerning for the people in the region, as well as the broader economic fallout. And I don't see a path forward, maybe unless Trump sort of declares victory and wanders away from it. But even if he does, will Iran actually accept it, bearing in mind that they are only really committed, it seems now, to making sure that the regime survives almost under any circumstances?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I think that we've reached that point now where the divergence in the goals of the US and Iran are just so far away from each other that it just makes any sort of settlement very, very challenging, you know, because, you know, if it was just the fact that the US wanted to destroy Iran's nuclear ambitions and they wanted to just wreck the infrastructure, wreck the military, and that was it, maybe they could come to some sort of arrangement. But the problem is that Trump has made it very clear that this is about regime change. And that is obviously a red line for the Iranian regime. So it's very difficult to find that point where two parties can agree to a lasting peace. And I think it's interesting that in the last 24 hours, we've seen a move. Now, I'm not sure how confirmed these reports are at this stage, but basically of Iran basically acting as almost highwaymen of the Strait of Hormuz, of you pay us X number of dollars and we'll let your ship through. And one wonders if the Americans were to turn around and just be like, well, no, we've had enough. We're not dealing with this anymore. You know, we're going to randomly throw some ordnance downrange, but we're not going to have this high intensity campaign continue. If that is the future for the Strait of Hormuz, or is the future of the Strait of Hormuz a militarized one under the United States? I mean, at the moment, there's two American amphibious assault fleets heading for the Persian Gulf, one of which is, I'm not sure if it's just departed San Diego or if it's due to do so in about the next 48 hours. But that also raises another question as well. One of those fleets of the USS Tripoli embarked from Japan a couple of days ago now, I think probably about a week ago. So it's a lot closer. But the other fleet, which left from San Diego or is about to leave from San Diego, that's going to take about 3 weeks to get there, which begs the question, is it going to be at least another 3 weeks before you see American boots on the ground in Iran, which means the Strait of Hormuz is going to stay closed for at least another 3 weeks, which for us in Australia, who are reliant on the Strait of Hormuz by proxy through our fuel imports, that could be a rather sizable problem for us.
Well, that takes us nicely into your slides, actually, because you've actually got some data. So let's switch into them. And, you know, the chart here predicated on the end is nigh, to which some say, well, I hope so. But, yeah, that's a rather neat way of summing it up, isn't it?
It is indeed. As usual, the charts are available at burnouteconomics.com. I just want to say a big thank you to everyone who has subscribed recently. We've had an absolutely bumper month for new subscribers, and I am very, very thankful for that and all the messages of support from the community. So we should get straight into the data. Now, this is directly from the Department of Climate Change, Energy, the Environment, and Water. What this shows is Australia's fuel stockpiles as a proportion of the number of days of consumption that will cover. Now, unfortunately, the latest data that is available from the government only covers up till the end of January. But as you can see, we basically have less than a month's fuel on hand. for the most vital things, which is, you know, jet fuel, diesel, and automotive gasoline. So we've got a rather sizable problem here. And it's just worth noting that Australia has the lowest levels of fuel and oil stockpiles in the entire, in the entire developed world, and by a fairly sizable margin. Most developed nations have at least 90 days. Even some developing nations, places like Thailand, have 100 days, whereas we're sitting here swinging in the wind with basically under a month on this particular metric from the federal government.
Yes, and that's worth saying that's before any of the recent ructions, right? So that was the normal course of business, and you can see that that chart shows you that over the recent history, it's being very low. Now, just to be clear, there are two international guidelines. There's the one that says you should have at least 90 days onshore or close to shore, right? Which means that Australia has been skating well below that for, well, forever, to be honest. Well, for a long, long time. And the other then is actually the decision about, well, what you should hold. And it's interesting, of course, that Morrison previously had the stocks over in the US. At least the government currently, when they actually came into power, did change that and at least brought it closer to. So I think Geelong and Brisbane is where some of the supplies are. But it shows you the sort of criticality of timing, because of course the ships that were dispatched from the Straits of Hormuz before are sort of arriving currently, but they're going to peter out pretty soon. And so when Bowen says we don't have a supply problem, it's a demand problem because people are actually stocking up, that's probably true. And he has again reaffirmed that at the moment the supplies are still landing as previously expected. So what's your theory on why it is that prices have gone way, way high, and in many places, particularly out in the regional areas, there is no supply?
I think that there is a sense of panic here in Australia. I think that people can look at the numbers, they can look at the fact that we are an island off in, you know, the bottom of the Southwest Pacific, and that we are far away from those supply chains. And if we do start to see some, you know, rather serious issues, running out of fuel is, or at the very least, the rationing of fuel is a very, very real risk. So I understand why farmers, why miners, and even why everyday people have done this. You know, why they've tried to secure fuel to secure their own interests. You know, because simply put, the government is just absolutely and hopelessly unprepared. You know, like, this is a unique problem in the developed world. Like, there was an article the other day, I believe it was from Bloomberg, and it was talking about the countries that are going to be most immediately impacted by this. It was a list that encompassed people like the Philippines and Pakistan and Bangladesh and Australia. Which one's the odd one out? You know, it's Australia, obviously. You know, we are a multi-trillion dollar economy that faces the very, very real prospect of running out of fuel. And you're absolutely right about the lags in all of this. And I think that is leading to a false sense of security, both among some policymakers and elements of the broader general public, because it takes somewhere between about 15 and 16 days and about 3 weeks to get from the Persian Gulf to the refineries of East Asia, places like Japan, South Korea, China, etc. And then it takes another, you know, depending on the timeline in question, it takes about another 5 to 7 days of that fuel then running through a refinery before it's then exported to Australia, which then takes another 2.5 weeks or 3 weeks. Obviously, it depends on the speed of the tanker. So you're talking about something that has a fairly significant lead-in time. You're talking about something that's not going to really start to show up in a significant impact until probably, I would say, you're going to start to see some misshipments, unless alternatives can be found, around about the middle of April. Roughly around then, you're going to start to see, you know, some of those misshipments, particularly from some of our export nations, as particularly from nations that are exporters to Australia. They're a lot closer to the Strait of Hormuz, places like Singapore or Malaysia, both of which are in the top, you know, the sort of top echelons of suppliers of fuel to Australia. So there is that there is that lag issue. And I think that the government has made an absolutely massive mistake by not getting people to voluntarily conserve fuel, by encouraging people to use public transport. Now, yes, it's not going to make a huge, huge difference in overall fuel supply. Maybe it's only going to save us 2% a day, 3% a day. But over the course of a week, over the course of a month, it adds up. And, you know, that could be the difference between the economy operating more or less as normal or us going into sort of real serious wartime-esque rationing. So, yeah, it's a deeply concerning picture, unfortunately.
Mm. And of course, people are reporting $3 plus a litre in some areas now, which is significantly high. It's interesting, in the UK, the average litre price has gone up by 10 pence. Which is
that's a really good example, though, isn't it? It's an example of the bifurcation between different sources of oil and how different markets interact in this sort of environment. Because generally speaking, like, markets across the world for, say, let's say jet fuel, hypothetically, are relatively, you know, move in relative unison. Obviously, there are local and regional supply issues that can impact markets. But if you look at what happened just in the first week and a bit of the war, the cost of jet fuel in Singapore went from about a bit under $100 a barrel to over $200 a barrel in relatively short order, because the supply just wasn't there. And because we are part of that regional distribution network, we are going to get hammered by those price pressures. Whereas, say, for example, in the United States, where they secure a lot of their own fuels domestically, they're much less exposed to that, particularly if you do see things like export bans and the like, or export tariffs, which have been, you know, proposed in some quarters in the US government.
Absolutely. Another interesting observation in Europe, of course, we're moving into the spring and summer. It's actually been quite a warm spring so far. So the demand for LNG for the next few months is somewhat lower than it would be if it was actually going into winter. Although the stocks, of course, in Europe are very low. And there are even negotiations to try and open pipelines that were closed off through the Ukraine crisis. I mean, you can't really make this stuff up. Oh, and by the way, China, of course, has restricted exports of some of its refined products as well, so because they want to keep it for their own economic use. So, yes, Australia is uniquely positioned. And, well, what about our refining capacity, Tariq? You know, years ago, we were actually refining a little bit more onshore than we are today.
Indeed, that is indeed correct. And this charts over time the capacity of Australia to refine fuels and other, you know, various oil byproducts. And basically, we, once upon a time, in about 2009, we had the ability to supply almost 80%, or we did supply almost 80% of our domestic fuel needs using domestic refineries. And over time, that's become less profitable, less economical, and that has led to the closure of refinery after refinery after refinery, which has left us in a real challenging position here, because instead of our refineries producing, you know, almost, well, I mean, obviously the demand has expanded, but let's say producing three quarters almost, or about 70% of our required fuel usage, it's about a bit over 20% these days. And if we did have a different set of circumstances, if those refineries were still operational, they would have 7 to 14 days worth of oil sitting there waiting to be refined, which would give us that additional buffer. Now, that doesn't get counted in that first chart. So that is very much a departure from where we were before in terms of our energy security. So we've definitely made a massive mistake here. And just because I thought it was interesting, I ran the numbers through AI the other day. And if anyone has more hard data on this, please feel free to let us know in the comments below. But I ran the numbers and I asked, what would it cost for us to build a storage facility for 100 million barrels of oil, and for us to have kept all those various refineries open, you know, even if it cost money to the taxpayer through various subsidies. And at the high end, it was about 20 billion. Now, obviously, you've got to pay for the fuel to fill it, but the fuel is an asset which you use, and you get some coin out of it. You might even be able to make a little bit of a profit here and there on some arbitrage when prices are very low. But $20 billion is about 130 days worth of NDIS funding for the next financial year. And, or it'll put expressed slightly differently, it's about 40% of that would have been paid for. And this is over the last 15 years, oh, sorry, 17 years. That would have been about 40% of that entire bill would have been paid for just through Albo's electricity subsidies. So you've got to ask people now, what would you have rather have had? Albo's cash splash or, you know, almost 50 million barrels of oil that could have been refined and supplied our domestic market? You know, I mean, it's just silly, really. I mean, I realize that there's this move to renewables and et cetera, but if you actually get into the nitty gritty in terms of what powers the nation, in terms of what powers, you know, the mining sector, the transport sector, the railways, the shipping, you know, the construction sector, all these different things, it's a huge, huge amount of diesel. And that it's going to be a very, very long time before all of that gets replaced, because frankly, the technology just isn't there yet. And, you know, even if we manage to get all the various gasoline cars off the road, the diesel trucks and everything else is still going to be a massive issue for our energy security for decades to come.
Absolutely. Well, of course, Australia being a big country is very reliant on diesel. And of course, I would highlight that a lot of our exports are absolutely reliant on continued supply of diesel to be able to power the machinery and everything else, to be able to actually make the exports go overseas and generate income. So from an income protection perspective, you'd think about it. The other way to think about it, I'm being a bit naughty here, you know, NDIS is big, but AUKUS is huge, $320 billion, right? Well, you know, would you prefer the mythical nuclear submarine in 15 years that may or may not arrive, right? Mirage in the future. Or would you have preferred an investment into that particular security strategy for the country that actually would have, well, not cost anything like as much? And interestingly, an observation on the current conflict, the war, as in Ukraine, is all about drones and small, facilities, not about these massive aircraft carriers that seem to be more of a problem rather than actually a help in the Gulf. Or indeed, if you think about, the sort of little Ukraine and its ability to be able to create these counterattack drones, well, they're now helping out in the Middle East. I wonder about the whole AUKUS thing. Seems to me to be a massive amount of money that probably shouldn't be spent. But more importantly, it also couples us to, well, frankly, an unreliable US.
Well, it's an interesting one, just looking at as you're saying, on the fuel consumption angle of all this, you know, like, because the question is like, okay, we are trying tooth and nail to get enough fuel into this country, and you know, this next, you know, 4 to 6 months is going to be the hardest time, because eventually market forces will take over and Australia's buying power will prove to be of assistance. But in the meantime, who misses out? You know, like, as I said, a lot of the, you know, say for example, 10% of the diesel usage in Australia is for agriculture. 6% is for the construction sector. The largest contributor by far is road transport, and about 20% of it flows to mining. So the question is, who misses out? Who is going to be told, no, you can't have that? You're going to have your economic activity impacted, And obviously the government is going to be absolutely hounded to make up for that, whatever that is, whatever that may be. So the question is who misses out? It won't be the farmers, because at the end of the day, not growing food in the middle of what could potentially turn into a global food crisis is going to look like pretty poor form. And then it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be road transport. It's not going to be the overwhelming majority of road transport, because the country's got to keep moving, got to move food, you got to move all sorts of things around for the economy to function. So is it possible that the government says to the mining sector, hey guys, well, maybe, you know, there's these projects that you're doing that are less than amazingly profitable at the moment, so we're just going to have to, you guys aren't going to get what you need? And I think that's a really, really big question, because who gets what? You know, who gets what in this entire, in this mess? And I think that's part of the problem right here. And I think that's part of why people are panicking, because there isn't a plan. Albo hasn't gotten up there and said, this is our timeline. This is what's going to happen. This is our contingencies. There's nothing. I mean, I'm not sure if you saw on Twitter, but I wrote an entire speech for Albo as if I was one of his speech writers. I think it was earlier this week.
Yes.
Yeah. And basically, you know, it's about being upfront with the people. Be upfront with the people, tell them that we've got contingency plans, build a contingency plan, and then share it with them. And then you don't have these people running off and going, well, you wouldn't eliminate it, but you could reduce the number of people going off and, you know, hoarding fuel, people who don't need it for their businesses, people who are just hoarding it because they're worried or they're scared. And to be completely honest with you, I understand. You know, I mean, while you know, my personal fuel reserves is what's in the tank of my car, I totally understand why people feel that way, because the government hasn't been forthcoming, they haven't been truthful, and they don't have a plan. I mean, they probably do have a plan, but the Australian people certainly don't know about it.
Well, they've got a fuel czar, so that's all right. That's going to solve everything, isn't it? So a bit of extra bureaucracy is going to make all the difference.
Well, I've always thought it was funny that they call people the czars. And how did things end for Nicholas II again?
Exactly. Yeah, not perfect. Now, on the question of the size of oil reserves, it's just worth making some comparisons, right, between some of the other countries. And, you know, Japan at one end of the spectrum with 254 days, and India and Indonesia at 25 and 23, which is, you know, not far from where we are.
Yeah, it just goes to show what developed countries with significant resources are doing with their energy security. I mean, I just find it astounding just how Australia has approached this, when, you know, Japan and South Korea both looked at this and they go, well, we don't make much oil, we need to be prepared for a crisis. And, you know, are there lines around the block in Japan? Are there people panicking over fuel? People are like, oh, well, you know, we're very concerned, and you know, we would like the conflict to be over, and, you know, we don't, you know, support how this is impacting us, etc. But we know we're going to be okay because our government's prepared for this. Whereas you compare that with Australia, and it's a completely different world.
Well, she'll be right. And I guess another way of looking at it is the jet fuel exports, right? Because that's another angle on the same analysis, which shows that actually a lot of jet fuel ultimately, guess where it comes from? It comes from the Middle East. And then, of course, it flows through via refining. So jet fuel is another. And, of course, Australia is particularly uniquely exposed because it's a long way from anywhere.
No, well, exactly. And then that brings us to the interesting development regarding everything with China. And China has recently banned the export of fuels, including jet fuel. So that is 32% of Australia's fuel gone. And that is rather a problematic little situation for us here, because it was reported in the AFR that two ships rocked up to China to get filled with jet fuel to come to Australia. And both of those ships apparently did not get loaded. They have set off to other destinations to, from what I can see, to procure fuel. But as the chart here illustrates, more than half of the volume of the average so far on a weekly basis of jet fuel exports has simply not turned up. Now, I think it's worth exploring exactly what's happening with this, particularly from an Asia Pacific perspective. The intelligence and logistics firm Kepler recently did an analysis on this, and they concluded that one of the most impacted locales was going to be the US West Coast because of the various shutdowns of refineries and, you know, the ending of a lot greater reserves on the West Coast of the US. It has become extremely reliant on the imports of fuel from Asia. So we are going to be competing with the US to try and get our hands on that fuel as it becomes scarcer and scarcer and scarcer. And countries look after themselves first. And there simply isn't enough fuel to go around because, as you can see from the chart, the biggest exporters of this fuel are places like South Korea. But then you've also got the aspects where some of the biggest exporters were places like Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or Oman, who now are either stuck behind the Strait of Hormuz and the blockade, and well, not the blockade, and the relative closure, or they're having their production and export facilities hit by Iranian attacks. So it's a bit of a mess, really.
And of course, the airlines have already put the costs of airline travel up, and there was more announcements today that, in fact, the costs would be going even higher. So now, just to bear in mind that inflation, of course, is going to be a problem because, of course, everything runs on fuel. But of course, it's interesting that when you look at the CPI calculation, well, airline travel is one of the inputs amongst many others. So yeah, sounds inflationary to me.
I think we're going to see a little bit of an ex volatile items thing going on with the CPI in that regard, to be honest with you, because if some of the various commentary that I have kindly been sent by elements of the aviation industry come to pass, yeah, the RBA and the government are not going to want that in the CPI because it is going to completely distort it in a very negative and unfavorable way.
Yeah, but of course the point there is that other elements within the CPI will also get hit too. So at one level, I can understand the RBA thinking, oh yeah, well, we've already got an inflation problem. Now this is, and remember that the decision to lift the interest rates were more about what had happened up to this point rather than taking account of what might or may not happen in the Straits of Hormuz. The inflation story is going to be one that's going to really be a problem. And I would remind everybody that, of course, we had through the COVID period, you know, we had weak economic activity, and then we had a roaring back of inflation afterwards, thanks to all of the ultra low interest rates and thanks to all the government handouts. Now, the question is now, well, what will happen this time? Because, of course, the Reserve Bank has lifted rates and the markets are expecting they're going to lift rates further ahead to try and get ahead of the inflationary pulse. But I'd also make the point that I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing government handouts, and so this same inflationary story could well be from the money supply side too. And then, of course, I'm waiting for the Reserve Bank to turn around and say, oh, we're in an economic crisis, so now we have to cut. I mean, we are in a very, very difficult situation. I noticed that in the US, in the UK, and elsewhere, other central banks met this week and they all said, well, we're going to wait and see what happens because we're not sure how this is going to play out, but it's going to be more inflationary. So yeah, this is a real problem in terms of trying to work out how the economic fallout is going to come through. But almost whichever way you look at it, Australia is almost uniquely exposed.
We are indeed. And I think that we've got a situation here where Albo is really going to have to play hardball to get us what we need. Because if we see a proportional reduction in our fuel supply that is relative to the loss of flows to the origin sources of our fuel imports, we are in very, very, very deep trouble. Because, you know, you're talking basically about you know, even if you take some of the most optimistic scenarios regarding pipeline output and piping it around the Strait of Hormuz and all those various things, you're talking about a reduction in Australia's fuel supply in order of, you know, at least a quarter, just gone. And, you know, that occurring potentially over a sustained basis. Now, obviously, eventually the power of, you know, the Australian economy, the power of the Australian currency is going to be able to, for us to, theoretically at least, secure the supplies we need. But in the meantime, it is an absolute Mad Max free-for-all out there. And everyone's just trying to get what they need for their purposes to keep their economies going. So while on one hand we're buying those tanker loads full of diesel and petrol from, you know, the US Gulf Coast, on the other hand, they're competing with us for the exports to Australia of fuel from places like South Korea that used to be ours, and now they want them because they need them. So it's just a really, really massive mess in that regard. And there isn't really a way of resolving this without, you know, just the passage of time. And unfortunately, Australia is going to be, what, you know, ground zero in the Western world for being uniquely exposed to this and for the potential for it to really hit our economy very hard. And I think it's just worth, you know, noting for a minute that, you know, let's say, you know, we can't get a quarter of the fuel we need. You know, let's say that hits our economy to the tune of, I don't know, let's say 10% of GDP. That $20 billion that it would have cost to build in the reliance to this, you know, within 4 weeks, 6 weeks, it's paid for itself. You know, but here we are. You know, we didn't have the foresight to do anything, even though we had COVID as a precursor and a warning of, hey, you know, if you don't get your supply chains together, bad things could happen to you, especially in this more volatile world.
Absolutely. And interestingly, you've got a breakdown there of the fuel imports by country, which is fascinating to see. South Korea is up there, actually. And I noticed that there was commentary today that they're trying to put more pressure on South Korea to send more stuff down to Australia, please.
Indeed. Well, that's where we're at the moment, unfortunately. And as is very clear from this chart, is the big three, South Korea, Singapore, and Malaysia, they together account for just a little under 2/3 of all Australia's fuel imports. Now, please note, this is of all fuel. This is of jet fuel, diesel, and petrol. So this is across the board. And it just serves to illustrate just how vulnerable we are, because these are nations that, I will just go to the next slide because it is incredibly relevant, that are directly reliant on the Strait of Hormuz at an aggregate level for a majority of their oil. So this is an absolutely huge problem. And this is going to start feeding into our system, feeding into our fuel stocks. As I said, likely around about the middle of April, give or take. I mean, obviously, it's going to depend on, you know, tanker timing, tanker speeds, all that sort of thing. But around about the middle of April is when the rubber starts to meet the road, unless we can make other contingency plans. So we have a rather sizable problem there. And as you can see, like, say, for example, a place like Malaysia, 75% of their oil imports come through the Strait of Hormuz. And while I'm sure that Malaysia, of which Australia is one of their biggest customers for fuel, would like to continue to provide us with fuel, at the end of the day, they can't provide us with what they don't have. And that is really, I think, the underlying message of this entire issue, this entire crisis. This isn't yet a crisis of prices. It will be. And that will be the driving force behind, you know, the issues that we face. But in the moment, in the next, you know, 3 months, 6 months, it is a crisis of availability, of getting the actual fuel, not the price that we're going to have to pay for it. So there's going to have to be some rather serious behind the scenes negotiations, or, in, you know, in the spotlight, if necessary, for Australia to get the fuel that we need. Because it means that for us to get what we need to take it from somebody else. Yep. This is mad. This is Mad Max at this scale, at this point. We either get what we need and someone else doesn't, or vice versa. It's that simple. So we've got to decide, you know, are we going to play hardball? Are we going to leverage our mineral wealth to say, well, if you don't give us what we need, what you've agreed to give us, we're not going to give you what we agreed to give you, because we can leverage that into getting what we need from somewhere else. And and I think as well, China, Thailand, they've both already stopped fuel exports. Both of them supply Australia. Now, the Thai and Chinese amount, it only comes to about 6% of Australia's fuel, but that's 6% of Australia's fuel that's gone. That's 6% of Australia's fuel that we're going to need to find somewhere else, in addition to the fact that all of our other suppliers are impacted by this crisis. So it's just an absolute mess. And you want the road warrior running the country, who, you know, playing hardball, telling people where to go if they don't give us what we need. But I'm a little bit concerned that we don't have that.
Well, yes, I just think of our current political masters and their ability to manage their way out of a wet paper bag seems to be a bit in question at the moment. This is a little bit of a more of a serious issue. And, do we have the leadership we need? Do we have the capability and capacity to be able to actually play those chips appropriately? History is telling us, I think, we've made bad decisions over the last 20 to 30 years. The question is, what's going to change? You know, are we actually going to make good decisions now, or are we going to continue to try to, oh, she'll be right, we'll muddle through, it'll be fine. When in fact, as you say, this is now, well, it's a global game, isn't it? Who actually is able to shout louder, use the big muscles to be able to actually get the limited supplies that are there? And you're right, it is a Mad Max sort of scenario. And boy, it could be quite nasty quite soon.
It definitely could. And I think that we are just, I realize I'm somewhat repeating myself here, but we are just so incredibly exposed to this. And I think the thing is, because of the fact that this is very much a uncertain scenario, like, you don't know if there's a tanker, hypothetically, let's say it's off the coast of North Queensland, right? And it's heading to Melbourne with fuel, or, you know, wherever the fuel depot is down there, I'm uncertain. But let's say it's heading, you know, to southeastern Australia. If someone in Japan or if someone in the west coast of the US decides that they need that fuel and they're willing to pay more for that fuel, we don't get that cargo. It could be sitting there. The government could be counting it in their version of the reserves because it's within Australia's exclusive economic zone. And then someone could pip us at the post and then it's gone. And that is one of the biggest problems with this entire scenario going forward, because it's a case of, okay, we've got X number of days of fuel. We've got X number of tankers coming, but we can't count on those tankers coming. We have to act as if some of them won't turn up. Now, maybe they will all turn up, but you can't count on it, which means you need to then cater policy and cater things like rationing and various fuel conservation measures to that reality, which is why I don't understand why we haven't started at least voluntary fuel conservation yet and putting out, you know, things, plans for things like free public transport, etc. Because the cost of that is a hell of a lot less than what it's going to cost if the economy starts running low on fuel and we have to really start consider rationing. I mean, I think the thing is where do you draw the line for rationing? You don't wait until you've only got 5 days worth of fuel left. That would just be silly. You have to consider it long before that. So is it 10 days, 12, 15? When does this start to drag on the economy? There's all these various questions that need to be answered. And I feel like we're just flying blind here. I think everyone's flying blind, but Australia is flying especially blind.
Well, I would say that until quite recently, around the world, and markets are a reflection of this, you know, everyone was saying, oh, it's going to be a very short thing and it's going to be contained. And yeah, it's going to be annoying for a few days, but then it's all going to bounce back. And I noticed that markets are beginning to get a little bit more coy now about, you know, what's going on. And, you know, it's just worth just sort of reflecting on the trajectory, insofar that, you know, here's the ASX 200, right? So you can see that markets are now turning down. You know, we're around over 9,100. Now we're at 8,428 as at currently. Markets are beginning to get twitchy because they're now realizing that actually maybe this is not going to be something that's going to actually just be a blip and then sort out. And yeah, I think our leaders and our politicians need to be taking strategic moves now, assuming that things could get very bad very quick, rather than saying, oh, don't worry, you know, we haven't got a supply problem. It's just a bit of demand, but, you know, we'll get Azar to fix that up. It's really important that people understand that our politicians owe us, from a, you know, just good policy perspective, owe us early intervention and early direction to try and actually whittle out forward what we've got, because we can't rely on what is or isn't coming.
Indeed. I mean, in a lot of ways, this feels a little bit like February of 2020. And I remember chatting to some friends. I won't say who, because I'm not sure if they want me mentioning this, but about what was going to happen with the pandemic. You know, I had friends with contacts in China, friends with contacts in the some of the health agencies in Europe, and you know, it was made very clear to me that things were going to go south, that it was unavoidable, and I think that's what I have a similar feeling now, unfortunately. And we need that. It doesn't need to get horrible for us. It's going to get horrible for someone. Don't get me wrong. Like I said, this is the Road Warrior Mad Max scenario. Someone is going to have to miss out, you know. But the question is does it have to be us? And, you know, obviously it's a rather self-interested perspective, but, you know, that's the world. And we need to make a decision as to how we're going to pursue this as a nation. And I think that there really needs to be some leadership. And to be completely fair, it's not like Morrison led that well at the early stages of the pandemic either. I mean, I remember about a week, maybe 10 days before before lockdown, he was talking about bringing back international students into the country. And, you know, that obviously fell by the wayside in about 5 minutes. But I just think that we've just got this vacuum of the necessary foresight and leadership to be acting on this now. And it's a deeply, deeply concerning scenario, because frankly, at this stage, I mean, I don't care about the politics of this. I don't think most Australians do. I care about having leadership that is going to get us through this crisis. I mean, that's why I wrote the speech for Albo, because I just got frustrated with the state of the leadership on this, because we need leadership. Because at the end of the day, this country isn't run by you. It's not run by me. It's not run, you know, by any number of other people who would be perfectly competent and capable in the role. It's run by Anthony Albanese. And he needs to choose to lead. Because frankly, I mean, we're already seeing the legacy of this, because, driving through just one of our major cities yesterday, you know, empty fuel pumps. You look at the map of fuel prices, and it's, oh, that's run out of fuel. That one's run out of fuel. Now, yes, obviously, there's always going to be an unavoidable need for some people to hoard, to take care of their own needs first, and I totally understand that. But if we could take a more considered approach, a more planned approach, where people feel more secure about our future, that the government has got our back, then I think we could do a whole lot better with this situation. It's never going to be perfect, but it could be better. And better is what we need right now.
Yes, I agree. It's leadership. And yes, the question is, do we have the right leadership in place? And are they doing the right things? And are they actually thinking this through and forward? We hope they are. But don't worry. It'll all be sorted out in the budget.
well, that's the thing. I mean, look, if you magically made me PM 3 weeks ago, I would have been an utterly ruthless bastard nicking fuel cargoes from anyone I could possibly could and parking them off the coast of Australia saying, yeah, I just spent $3 billion on fuel. Yeah, I did. You only ain't getting it, but we're all sweet, you know, and that was possible. You know, I mean, yeah, you'd be an utter bastard for doing it, but that's your job as the Prime Minister. It's not your job to be friendly with everyone. It's your job to look after your country.
Mm.
And that's just the way the cookie crumbles, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point. Now, as we come towards the end of the show, there's a couple of other things I just want to touch on, because we had the population statistics updated this week. And interestingly, that our population went up. More than 300,000 of which were, guess what? Via migration.
No.
Yes, no. Really surprising.
Sayers and Sars. you mean all these people who've been very, very unpleasant to us for quite a while now were wrong? No, Martin. You mean the center of population was right this whole time, that net long-term and permanent arrivals is a leading indicator? Oh, my.
Such a shock, isn't it? Right. And it's what fascinated me more was that almost none of the media outlets reported the ABS data that came out, which is really interesting.
Did you see my chart the other day on net long-term and permanent arrivals against rental growth, by any chance?
Yes.
If you've got it, please put it up on the screen, because it shows that rental growth lags net long-term and permanent arrivals by about a quarter. The rental market doesn't give a crap whether someone is counted as part of net overseas migration or not. It doesn't matter. What matters is the number of people who require housing. And that is what drives the demand for rentals. It's what drives vacancy rates, and it's what drives rental growth. And here we are, shockingly, exactly the same pattern that has repeated time and time again, has repeated again. Oh my. I think it's interesting just the fact that net long-term and permanent arrivals shows this huge surge. Rental growth shows this huge surge. And I'm not sure if net overseas migration is capturing that adequately enough now. Now, some people say, oh, it's because of working holiday visas, people staying under a year, people on other visas. And maybe they're right. I don't know. I'm not sure. But if that is the case, there is this huge undercurrent of potentially hundreds of thousands of people on these visas in Australia who are not being counted in the official numbers, but are out there. You know, some of them are out there working. Some of them are out there renting houses. And that is rather problematic when you want to calculate things like, you know, the labor force. Or do we have enough houses?
Well, it's interesting. The ABS, when they published the employment statistics this week, made the point that they'd actually updated the population model. They try and do it every 3 months so that it doesn't get too far behind the census, right? And I'm thinking, well, you're still lagged. You're still way off where in fact we are. So that could explain some of the really weird findings that we're getting in some of the employment data at the moment as well. So, you know, when you've got such a strong growth in underlying population, and that's going to continue, I think, for the foreseeable, potentially, it's going to actually impinge significantly. And, of course, you know, you can think about the impact on housing and, you know, supply and demand. As you say, rentals are definitely hit first. But it's a little bit more than rentals too, isn't it?
It is indeed. Now, this chart here is based on the data from CoreLogic, also known these days as Cotality. What this shows is the income required to purchase a median house in these locales in May 2022 and October 2025. Which is shortly before this particular report was released. And as you can see, in the vast majority of the nation's capital cities, it's now very much a two average full-time income requirement to be able to purchase a house, to purchase the median house. And, you know, that's quite reflective of your daughter, isn't it, Martin?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. And I've been saying this for some time, and I noticed that CBA, when they do their housing affordability calculation, now predicates it on 2 full-time incomes. They just assume, right? And I see exactly the same, that, you know, you cannot get a house unless you've got, well, honestly, above average incomes, well above average incomes, which means that you need, you know, two incomes plus. And by the way, that will explain some of the employment data as well, because people are still chasing multiple jobs and trying to, you know, generate more income in to be able to actually pay for the housing. That's true also whether you're in the rental sector or whether you're actually with a mortgage. So once again, you can see the cracks appearing in housing affordability. Now, if we get this economic overlay that we've been talking about, and, you know, things go a bit pear-shaped as well, and suddenly incomes start to get compressed and costs go even higher, then this is going to put a big question mark under the momentum in the housing market generally, because it's way out. It's way above where it should be from a long-term trend perspective. So I'm watching this quite, you know, openly at the moment, thinking, is this now going to be a turning point for the property market? And I know everyone says, oh, yeah, back on property again. Well, yeah, but it's important to understand how the dynamics in property links back to this broader economic context that we've been talking about for the last 45, 50 minutes. Because I do think there are some interesting questions ahead. You know, the reports over the weekend, auction clearance rate, not so good. Oh, panic, panic. People are, you know, it's amazing how the media has sort of picked this up and started questioning it. But we are in an unsustainable position here with housing affordability. Something's got to give at some point. It's just a question of what gives first.
Indeed. I mean, just for a bit of perspective with the chart, the thing is, like, depending on which estimate you go by, and unfortunately, the best thing we do have at this stage is estimates until the next census, the median household income is about $104,000 at a national level. So basically, most at the median, households have about half of what they need to buy what the median house in the nation's capitals. So that in and of itself just is illustrative of just how overvalued property is relative to incomes. Now, naturally, you can say, oh, well, people paying the mortgages and, you know, prices are going up. And, well, yeah, I mean, look at the numbers. You've got reaccelerating migration from a level that is already higher than is reaccelerated above the pre-COVID record high. You've got still collapsed levels of stock on the market. You know, by some metrics, the level of stock has dropped over half compared with what it was in the decade prior to the pandemic. So yes, obviously you've got those support mechanisms for the market, but then you've got to look at how affordable housing actually is. I mean, I find it really funny that you look at this commentary from the US, even from some of the investment banks, even, you know, Goldman Sachs, even from, you know, some of the mainstream banks, you know, JP Morgan, you name it. They're all like, housing prices are unsustainable. And they're talking about housing prices at 4.7 times median household income.
Yep.
And we're talking about housing prices at near as makes no difference, 9 or 10. And it's dragging on the economy enormously. And there is that huge, huge risk there. But Australia's housing market is not a free one. It's not a free market. It's a market that is deeply, deeply rooted in government intervention. Oh, well, you know, you go back to 2008. Oh, well, things have gone south. Cash first home buyers grant. You know, you look back to 2020. Oh, things have hit the fan. We're crash diving interest rates, 3-year mortgages for everyone under 2%. You know, form an orderly line. Oh, we're going to give you home builder as well. Want to do a reno? Do a reno. Oh, it's on me. Go for it. And I can see that happening again. You know, I think it's, if this crisis continues, I guarantee you, we will not see out we will not see out 2026 without government intervention to support the housing market. I guarantee it.
I agree. Absolutely. And by the way, the other point there is going back to the oil situation. building and construction industry needs oil to be able to actually run their machinery to build, right? So actually, suddenly the supply of property may also continue that journey down rather than up, because while approvals were up a little bit, new starts aren't necessarily up that much at the moment. And of course, the cost of construction continue to rise, as well as cost of materials. So you've got this other force, which is actually to build anything is going to cost more, and we're going to get less of it. So yeah, there's, you know, we are, you can see all of this sort of playing out. But the playbook from COVID was, yeah, have some more money, you know, let's go and support the housing market again. So yes, I'm absolutely expecting that to be the case this time around. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, yeah, you pull it out of superannuation, that's fine. Did it before, that wasn't a problem. Do it again, you know, feel free, help yourself. So all of these things are going to be into the mix, I suspect. And I guess just as we sort of, you know, round this out, the unemployment growth or the employment growth is a really interesting little stat that you've got here.
It is indeed, because, you know, there is the sort of the focus, how many jobs have we created in headline terms? How, you know, what's the unemployment rate, et cetera. So I got to thinking, and I'm just like, well, let's drill down and actually look at full-time employment, because that got quite hammered in the recent data. And I thought, okay, well, let's look at the trend unemployment numbers. Not the seasonally adjusted ones that are jumping up now like a yo-yo. Although I will note that since July last year, the economy has created just 12,700 new full-time jobs in seasonally adjusted terms, while adding hundreds of thousands of people to the labor force. But here we are. Sorry, to the working age population, I should say. And as you can see from the chart we've got here, which is, as I said, the trend level of rolling 12-month full-time employment growth, it was already declining to an uncomfortable level prior to the war. And if it continued to persist there, we would have some issues. But with the war, with the impact to confidence, with the fact that ANZ recently reported that consumer confidence had collapsed in headline terms to the lowest level since March of 2020. That, and the fact that we have just frankly almost unprecedented levels of non-pandemic era uncertainty, what exactly is going to happen? Are you going to see businesses just be like, no, we're just going to pull back on the hiring, we'll see what things look like in 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, whatever. And what is that going to do to the Australian labor market? And that's without going into the more sort of, you know, deeply Mad Max scenarios of we don't have enough fuel for people to get to work and now businesses are collapsing.
Absolutely. Well, the truth is, I'm seeing it in my surveys, a lot of people are really under huge pressure. You know, we never got out of the problems over the recent times. The mortgage stress and rental stress metrics are very high. The cash flow pressures are very high. And it's interesting that the household spending is, well, remarkably weak, really, isn't it, when you actually step to look at it?
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised by this. I mean, we spoke about the household spending metric within the national accounts last week on how it declined in per capita terms, but this is overall household spending, not per capita, just overall, and it's nominal. And this was showing some very worrying signs. And this is only up to the end of February. So this basically has no impact from the war in the Middle East. So it was already deteriorating fairly significantly before, you know, the current crisis began. So it's not following the normal pattern that we've seen in recent years. And it's also worth noting that, as I said, this is just nominal. This is inflation adjusted. Nor is it adjusted for the fact that, you know, January and February see some of the largest levels of migration for the year. So, you know, you'd think all those people turning up, getting, you know, buying things, buying, you know, household items, buying, you name it, you know, buying cars, all these different things, that it would boost things. But no, it's quite a concerning picture, if I'm honest.
Well, it's consistent with my surveys. So I'm seeing more and more people with less capacity to spend and still having to spend more on the things they have to buy rather than the things they want to buy. And as you say, when you actually take account of the bigger population base we've now got, as I mentioned earlier on, you would expect to see this number going up, but it's not. And so that suggests to me that we are actually, again, at a bit of an economic crossroads here. And I suppose that really sums up, you know, quite nicely, as I mentioned, the Schrödinger story, right? So, you know, you got one of two futures here. You know, if the Straits of Hormuz gets open, and if actually peace descends in the Middle East, and we get some of this bounce back in terms of supply, then maybe things won't be that bad. But if in fact it goes on for a lot longer, then things are going to be quite well. I think we saw Chris Richards, and he actually had, you know, referring to the Treasury's modelling, right? He says he's got an oh dear, an oh no scenario, right? You know, and in one case, inflation goes up to what, 4.5%, and the other it's above 5%, and the GDP gets squeezed dramatically. I think we're in this Schrödinger's future, but I'm not confident that our leaders get it. I'm not confident they're doing the right things at the moment to tackle it.
No, and I mean, I would be, if I was them, I'd be looking at the recent news overnight from the US that President Trump has requested $200 billion to prosecute the war. And so far, the war has cost about $25 billion. So I don't think that we're especially prepared for Trump to have to spend all that money, which indicates, you know, the war going on for potentially at least another, at least, you know, 3 months, 4 months worth. And if we're still sitting here in 3 or 4 months and the Strait of Hormuz remains status quo, we're going to be staring in the barrel of a very, very challenging situation. And we're going to see some things, frankly, outright breaking in parts of the world.
Well, as we said in the title of the show, up the creek without a paddle. Let's hope not, Tariq. But anyway, thank you very much for that. A very important conversation as always. We'll check in again a little bit down the track and see where we're going. But let's try and find a paddle and start paddling, hopefully, and maybe avoid some of the shenanigans that are likely to come. Tariq, thank you very much. We'll catch you again.
No worries, mate. Thanks for having me.
See ya. Take care.
Bye, mate.